And we want to talk now about swatting. Ever heard of it? It's a dangerous form of harassment where someone places a hoax call to the police telling them there's been something like a murder or an ongoing hostage situation at the target's home. A SWAT team then rushes to the scene, heavily armed and prepared for a dangerous situation. 2 years ago, an unarmed man died during such a raid. We've mentioned swatting before on our program. Police are still grappling with how to handle these kinds of calls. Many of them come in anonymously. But recently, two cases targeting high-profile Black writers caught our attention. Just last week, Ijeoma Alu, a Seattle writer and author of So You Want to Talk About Race, described her experience of being swatted. She received a call from police that there had been reports of gunshots at her home. There wasn't. And Pulitzer Prize-winning Miami Herald columnist Leonard Pitts Jr. was swatted earlier this summer. He joins us now to talk about it. Leonard, welcome.
Thank you.
So the weekend before July 4th in your home in Maryland, you woke up to a call from the police. If you can, pick up the story from there.
Well, the call came through at 4:48 in the morning. The caller ID identified it as City of Bowie in Maryland, which is where I live. The caller identified himself as the Bowie Police Department and asked if I'd looked outside my window lately. And it's 4:48 in the morning, so of course I haven't looked outside. And he tells me that, quote, you know, half the City of Bowie Police Department is at my front door, and they've received a call that I've murdered my wife and that I need to come downstairs and talk to them, basically. My murdered wife is sitting up, you know, in bed next to me trying to figure out what's going on, and I'm on the phone with at 4:48 in the morning. And I go downstairs, and they have two spotlights, one on my left, one on my right, and I'm effectively blind. And a voice from somewhere out there in the darkness tells me to put down the cell phone, which I do, and to come forward, which I do. And about halfway across, maybe on my neighbor's lawn, they direct me down to my knees, hands clasped behind on top of your head, and then somebody comes around and handcuffs me. And they take me over to the back behind the police car and explain to me that they've received a call that I've murdered my wife. I didn't find this part out until later, but the caller also told them that I was going to open fire on the police once they responded.
This sounds terrifying. It sounds surreal. And yet you say that you weren't afraid. Why?
It was surreal, and I think, you know, maybe part of it was that, you know, I had just awakened, and I'm still at that threshold where you're trying to separate reality from the dream, you know, how it is when you've awakened abruptly in the middle of the night. But I think the bigger part was that the police themselves were not out of control. They were very calm. And once I saw that and the fact that nobody was yelling at me or cursing at me or threatening me or any of the rest of that stuff, my feeling was that, you know, if we could just go through whatever it was that they needed to go through to assure themselves.
They would see that nobody, your wife was alive.
Yeah. Matter of fact, she came to the door a moment later. They're going to see my wife's alive. They're going to see nothing's happening at the house and everything will be okay. It's just, for me, it was just a matter of let's get to that moment without anything happening.
Right. So all of this happened. Were you surprised by how police handled it, that they reacted in this way?
I was pleasantly surprised because this was a few days after the story had broken about the police in Arizona, I believe it was, maybe Phoenix, essentially brutalizing an African-American family over a shoplifting incident. So to be treated as I was, an assumption of murder, a suspicion of murder. Yeah, I was really surprised that it went as well as it did.
So usually in these cases, the person accused of swatting has individual motives. But we're also learning that there are these crowdsourcing websites where folks there can call on people to do like a mass swat on someone. Why do you think you were targeted?
Oh, I'm pretty sure somebody took exception to something that I wrote in the column. I wouldn't be surprised if whoever swatted me has a MAGA hat somewhere in their closet that they wear very often.
I mentioned that Black writer Ijeoma Alu, who lives in Seattle, was targeted specifically, she believes, by white supremacists. She she writes about race and white supremacy. And she had actually been in touch with police and talked to them a bit about the fact that she had received information that she might be on some of these swatting websites. There are other folks like Rihanna, Simon Cowell, all types of people who have been swatted. And then also everyday people, like there was just a victim in Iowa this week. What do you think should be done? Who do you think should be held accountable or possibly more safeguards in place to stop this type of thing from happening?
Well, the understanding that I have from the police, and it's really very rudimentary, but that somehow these people are able to route their calls through these internet services, internet providers, and maintain anonymity. And I don't think you should be able to do that. Bottom line, I don't think you should be able to call specifically 911 and maintain anonymity through those means. That is ridiculous to me. And then the fact that in my case, police apparently are having to serve subpoenas to get the information they need. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. So I would like to see something happen there, whether it's technologically, legally, or both, where people can't just, from some random point on earth, phone in a false call and upend your life.
You write about things that many people may not agree with. There are lots of other people who write not only about race, but they may write about gender issues that have also been targeted. And you said that you weren't afraid when this happened, in part because you had woken up in the middle of the night. But what would you say to those who are out there who are on those lists, who are feeling afraid about the work that they're doing and about the potential for this and not being afraid?
I don't know if there's any magic comforting words. This is the cost of doing business, in, particularly in the world that we're in today. I will tell you this much. Back in 2007, when I had issue with death threats, a bunch of neo-Nazis, I was given an award by the NABJ, National Association of Black Journalists. I kind of jokingly call it an award for not getting killed. But the thing that I said in the acceptance speech was that, you know, for a while, this was the worst thing that had happened to me. This was a terrible, and difficult moment in my life. But then I thought about it, and Medgar Evers would have called it Tuesday. You know, Martin Luther King would have called it Tuesday. And when you really stop and think and look at what others who have come before you have gone through, and they never faltered and they never buckled and they did what had to be done, it kind of puts into perspective what you're dealing with you know, some random idiots making phone calls and doing things of that nature. I mean, you know, Medgar Evers would be grateful. I would have been grateful if for my quote-unquote problem.
Miami Herald columnist Leonard Pitts, Jr., thank you so much for talking with us.
You're quite welcome.